Well, I want to start today by, I don't know, maybe some of you have seen, there used to be kind of this thing going around if you were to go and see a therapist, you know, they used to do these things called Rorschach tests or the ink blot test. And it was kind of like, look at this ink blot and tell me what you see. And it was supposed to reveal something about, you know, some Freudian ego problem that you have or something. I want to put an image on the screen, and it's going to seem completely and totally nonsensical, and that's okay. I want you to take a look at this image, and what I want you to do, don't say out loud what you see. What I want you to do is I want you to simply, you know, you got your bulletin here. I want you to write down somewhere in your notes right now, just what do you see in this splattering of ink, this seemingly meaningless picture? You know, there's not necessarily a right or wrong answer. Just write down what you see in the picture. Don't say it out loud. Don't say it out loud. Just write down what you see. If you see anything, or if you're just like, nope, it's utterly, completely meaningless. All right? Okay. Give you a moment. Write down if you see anything, you know. We're not going to do any Freudian psychoanalysis here, but all right. So what I want you to do is I want you to just share with your neighbor real quick, quietly, so you don't necessarily tell the whole room what you saw. Just kind of whisper to your neighbor, share with them what you wrote down. What do you see? What do you see in the picture? Oh, this is fun. I can hear from up here some wild ideas being shared together. All right, let me draw you back in here. Okay. I don't want anybody to say out loud yet what they saw, if they see anything at all. Maybe it's just chaotic, meaningless, you know, just a bunch of ink on a page, on a digital screen now. But check out what's going to happen. This is going to be really, really fun and interesting. As soon as I tell you what to look for, you're going to have a epiphany, okay? There is a Dalmatian dog sniffing the ground. Who got that? Whoa, wow. Congratulations. Very good, very good. I got it. Now, good job, Nate. Good job. Okay, so maybe you're like, I still can't see it, but I bet most of you, now that I've said it, you instantly see it. And what are you saying to yourself? How could I have missed it, right? It was right there in front of me. The visual information has not changed. There it is, if you still were struggling to see it. I have not changed in any way the visual information on the screen. Your eyes have received the same data as before, but you know what's happened? Your brain has changed. Why? Because you began to interpret through a different expectation. The story that a dog is here suddenly made the invisible visible to you. And this is a striking example of what psychologists, cognitive scientists call predictive processing. So we used to think a long time ago that our brains functioned like a camera, that we just, you know, we were taking pictures of the world and processing it. But we've actually come to find out that is not the case. Your brain does not function like a camera, like just taking in raw data, light and sound, and then assembling it into this picture of reality. We now know the brain does something far more complex and strange. Your brain functions much more like a prediction machine. It is a storyteller. We actually start with expectations based on past experiences, beliefs, patterns that we've seen before, and then we interpret our sensory data through the light of those expectations. It's called predictive processing. We do not just see what's there, we see what we expect to be there. But what happens when what we expect to see keeps us from seeing what is really there? I want to invite you to open up your Bibles this morning to Matthew chapter 20. We've been going through the Gospel of Matthew, and we are now approaching Holy Week. Next Sunday is Palm Sunday. This is our last Sunday of Lent. We're in Matthew chapter 20, and we're going to begin together in verse 17. Now Jesus was going up to Jerusalem. On the way, he took the 12 aside and said to them, "We are going up to Jerusalem, and the Son of Man will be delivered over to the chief priests and the teachers of the law. They will condemn him to death and will hand him over to the Gentiles to be mocked and flogged and crucified. On the third day, he will be raised to life." This is actually the third time in Matthew's gospel that Jesus explicitly spells out for his disciples what is going to happen. Here is the mission. Here's how it's going to happen. And interestingly enough, we see in each time Jesus does this, his disciples completely miss it. And for some reason, they still can't see it. They have a different story ingrained into their mind of how this is going to work. And so their predictive processing is precluding them from seeing what Jesus is explicitly telling them. In fact, the very first instance of this is actually back in Matthew 16. Jesus predicts his death just like he does here. And Peter has the audacity to pull Jesus aside and rebuke him. He's like, "Jesus, what are you talking about, man? You can't say that sort of stuff." How the disciples respond to this third instance is really interesting. But first, we need to understand a key phrase here for Matthew, and it has a ton of literary significance in this biography of Jesus that Matthew gives us. It's when Matthew says, "Now Jesus was going up to Jerusalem." Jerusalem is a place where the prophets are killed. Throughout Israel's backstory in the books of the prophets, we see over and over again, Jerusalem is the place where the prophets are killed. So you have that story, but you also have another story. The other story that is kind of in the collective consciousness of the Jewish people at this time is that Jerusalem is the center of political power. Jesus is headed towards his climactic moment of his mission. But whether you see him as going to Jerusalem to be killed as a prophet, or whether you see him as going as some sort of revolutionary, glorious revolutionary takeover of power, depends on what you expect to see. Now, I want you to take a look at what happens in the very next scene here in Matthew's gospel, because Matthew is intentionally choosing to put these stories side by side together for a clear intentional purpose. There are probably thousands, if not millions, of other things that happened in the life of Jesus day to day that we do not have information to in our gospels. So our gospel authors, and one of the reasons why we have four different gospel portraits, is each one of those authors intentionally selects particular scenes and arranges them together for a particular purpose. And we're going to see why Matthew has chosen, hey, this is the next part of the story I want to tell you. So let's pick up here in verse 20. See what happens in this next scene. "Then the mother of Zebedee's sons came to Jesus with her sons and kneeling down asked a favor of them. 'What is it you want?' he asked. She said, 'Grant that one of these two sons of mine may sit at your right hand and the other at your left in your kingdom.' 'You don't know what you're asking,' Jesus said to them. 'Can you drink the cup I'm going to drink?' 'We can,' they answered. Jesus said to them, 'You will indeed drink from my cup, but to sit at my right or left is not for me to grant. These places belong to those for whom they have been prepared by my Father.' When the 10 heard about this, they were indignant with the two brothers. Jesus called them together and said, 'You know that the rulers of the Gentiles lord it over them, and their high officials exercise authority over them. Not so with you. Instead, whoever wants to become great among you must be your servant, and whoever wants to be first must be your slave, just as the Son of Man did not come to be served, but to serve, and to give his life as a ransom for many.'" So the two brothers here that are being mentioned are James and John. They are two disciples of Jesus. They are known as the Sons of Thunder, which is like the awesomest nickname. I would imagine they probably had a metal band that they were in, or maybe they were tag team wrestlers. That is a great nickname for a duo, the Sons of Thunder. And the Sons of Thunder here, along with their mother, have an expectation about what this kingdom of heaven is going to look like. They're on the road to Jerusalem, and they are likely interpreting this journey to Jerusalem being about, at the end, there's going to be a glorious political revolution, and we are going to be able to sit with Christ enthroned in these glorious thrones of power. So they're getting stoked about this opportunity. They see Jerusalem on the horizon, and mom goes, I better try to get a good word in here for my sons, right? Like, I'm going to sneak to the front of the line before this all goes down, and I'm going to put a good word into Jesus for my sons, so they might be able to be the ones that are like second in command to him when this all goes down. And what Jesus says to them, I'm paraphrasing here, what he literally says is, you don't know what you're asking. But if I were to paraphrase Jesus, I would say, you know, what you are expecting to see is actually keeping you from seeing. Jesus says to them specifically, he goes, can you drink the cup that I'm about to drink? And cup here, this is a loaded metaphor in the first century. There is biblical precedent, especially in the Old Testament prophets, for a cup to be a symbol of God's righteous judgment and justice coming to the nations. Like in Jeremiah 25, 15 through 16, the prophet says, this is what the Lord, the God of Israel, said to me. Take from my hand this cup filled with the wine of my wrath, and make all the nations to whom I send you drink it. When they drink it, they will stagger and go mad because of the sword I will send among them. So this, when Jesus says, are you going to drink this cup? They might be thinking about this prophecy from Jeremiah and going, oh yeah, this is when judgments come into the nations. This is when a sword is coming to the nations. Oh yeah, Jesus, we're the Sons of Thunder. We can drink that cup with you, right? It's also possible, because drink of this cup also was an idiom in the first century, that, it could be James and John heard Jesus use that phrase and go like, yeah, Jesus is inviting us to accept our fate, to accept our destiny. You know, maybe they might have interpreted it as, hey, this is going to get messy, and if I go down, are you ready to go down with me? To which, again, they go, Jesus, Sons of Thunder here. It's kind of in the name, right? Like, yeah, we'll do that. Either way, it's clear that these Sons of Thunder and their mother completely misunderstand, as so do the rest of the disciples, what this is all about. To which Jesus tries to explain to them again. He says, guys, you are not seeing what this is supposed to be about. You're stuck thinking like the Romans here. You think like significance, glory, and power. You think that is the goal. And what does he say specifically? Quote, not so with you. Instead, whoever wants to become great among you must be your servant, and whoever wants to be first must be your slave, just as the Son of Man did not come to be served, but to serve and to give his life as a ransom for many. The way of the kingdom is not like what you're seeing from the Romans. The world does not get healed and set right via that way. You have aspirations for greatness? Awesome. Let me redirect those. You know what greatness looks like? Learning how to serve. What we expect to see can so often keep us from seeing. This was the case for Jesus' own disciples. Now, I want you to pay close attention to what happens in this very next scene, because it's not accidental. Matthew is including this detail intentionally. All right, so let's see what happens in this very next scene. We'll go down to Matthew, verse 29, I should say. As Jesus and his disciples were leaving Jericho, a large crowd followed him. Two blind men were sitting by the roadside. And when they heard that Jesus was going by, they shouted, Lord, Son of David, have mercy on us. The crowd rebuked them and told them to be quiet, but they shouted all the louder, "Lord, Son of David, have mercy on us." Jesus stopped and called them. "What do you want me to do for you?" he asked. "Lord," they answered, "we want our sight." Jesus had compassion on them and touched their eyes. Immediately they received their sight and followed him. Okay, so just track with me here. Jesus and his disciples, they've left Jericho. And leaving Jericho, this is significant. We don't get it without understanding some of the geography and the cultural context. And this is the first time Matthew has specifically mentioned where they are at on the road to Jerusalem. Jericho is the last stop. It's the last stop before you get to Jerusalem. Passover is coming. And so there's crowds of pilgrims that are on this road to Jerusalem. They're making the trek. Not only that, but I want you to see, like, this is literally an uphill climb. I want you to take a look here. This is where Jericho sits. So if you can picture, there's the Dead Sea. They're kind of moving past the Dead Sea. Jericho is at the bottom of this mount. They've just gone out of Jericho. They are looking at an uphill battle, literally an uphill battle to Jerusalem. Elevation, 2,474 feet above sea level. So is this going up? Is this going up going to be like, we're going up and now we're taking over? Is this like a rise to power and fame and glory? That's what the Son of Thunder and the other disciples think. Or is this something else? You know, presumably, all of those in Jesus' traveling party, if they're anything like Jesus' closest followers who are getting it wrong, they're misunderstanding what this journey to Jerusalem is all about. They think they're climbing a mount to glory. They're literally going uphill. But Jesus has explicitly told them now three times what he's going to Jerusalem to do. And directly after the previous one, we just saw Jesus predicted what happened. Two disciples couldn't see what it was about. They couldn't see the point. Two disciples couldn't see what the point was. You could say in some sense they were blind to it. Now what happens just before two men blind? We've got two disciples who can't see. We've got two men on the road who now can't see. And what happens? Jesus opens their eyes, and what do the two who could not see now do? They follow him. Follow him where? To the cross. These men have now had their eyes open, and what do they now see? I must follow Jesus up the mount. We cannot see rightly without following the way of the cross. We simply cannot see how the world is supposed to function without following the way of the cross. Each of us, we have inherited instincts. We have cultural inputs that cause us to frame the story of the world wrongly. And therefore, what that ends up doing in us, because we frame it wrongly, because we can't see the Dalmatian in the picture, what we end up doing is we perpetuate continued cycles of pain, injustice, and death in the world. So we are born with this like proclivity towards moving away from the good. And not only that, we sometimes have family systems, the schools we were raised in, the environment, the very movies and television series that we took in through our childhood, which cause us to think this is the way the world is supposed to work. We have all of those things that have been inputs into our own story. And sometimes those inputs keep us from seeing. And so I want to talk about here, there are two ditches that we can fall into that are common patterns from our, just even our genetic predisposition to the cultural inputs we've had over the course of our life to wrongly misunderstand what the way should look like. The first lie I want to dispel is that this idea that we win through dominance, The question is, do we win through dominance or do we win through sacrifice? Since the late 19th century, at the very least, if not before that, but we'll just go back just that far in our cultural journey, we've had this idea of the survival of the fittest, and that the survival of the fittest is the way the world works. We could go back to Thomas Malthus, the work of Charles Darwin, the work of Friedrich Nietzsche in the 19th century, and then into the turn of the 20th century. Everything from biology to the social sciences to economics was framed, the story was framed as a ruthless competition for limited resources where only the strong survive. That's the story. You could call it social Darwinism. And in this ruthless competition, the only way you can possibly win is through ruthless dominance. People would look at chimpanzee troops, for example. You take biologists looking at chimpanzee troops, and they would notice this trend. Well, it seems like in the chimpanzee troop, the most dominant, aggressive alpha male is the one that gets to the top of the food chain and gets to be the leader of the group. And so extrapolating from that, we took in this narrative that, you know what it takes to win? You've got to be the most dominant alpha in the group. This story is actually what drove much of the Nazi movement in the 1930s. If there was going to be, the Germans were anticipating this Third Reich. We want a 1,000-year reign of peace and prosperity. So the way that we're going to get that through that lens was through dominance. It was through the ruthless domination of the world. So what did they do? They killed off their sick and disabled. They relegated to prison labor and death camps the groups of people they deemed inferior, and they literally, this literally happened, they literally tried to breed what they perceived to be the most genetically superior German people. They were called the Lebensborn. The story they believed determined their behavior. That was the story of winning through dominance. And you know what it led to? You all know it. Hell on earth. It was the antithesis of the cross. And so what did it bring? It brought death. You know, kind of like that, you know, you can picture Hitler almost as that alpha chimp leader, right? Yeah, he rose to power. But was his rule long? Did it lead to life? Did it lead to 1,000 years of peace and prosperity? No. And interestingly enough, biologists now realize, after more extensive study over the last nearly 150 years on things even like those chimpanzee groups, that this story of survival of the fittest, and if by survival of the fittest we mean the survival of the most dominant, isn't even true in the natural world. In fact, there was this really interesting, groundbreaking research done by a primatologist named Franz de Waal. And she clearly demonstrated that among those chimpanzee groups that people were pointing to and saying, hey, this is how it works. It's the most dominant, ruthless alpha wins. Yeah, the alpha male wins. The one that dominates through fear, they do make it to the top, but they're typically overthrown. And those who maintain status through bonding, generosity, altruism, caring for the weak, it's actually those leaders that have, you could call them leaders in a chimp group if you would, those leaders have a longer, more prosperous reign. So if we were to actually step back and even look at the way nature works, it's not even survival of the dominant. Dominance might give you some short-term control, but your reign is going to end quickly and terribly. If you want long-term influence, if you want your reign to last, it is through the path of service, sacrifice, and other-centered love. So we have that temptation on the one end, the temptation to win through dominance, but I also want to speak to another one. And oftentimes in church context, we can misunderstand the way of the cross. Yes, we are called to sacrifice. Yes, we are called to give, but it's also important that we realize self-sacrifice in and of itself isn't the goal. It's seeking the good of all. So some of you, for example, you know, you might have an inherited predisposition that's like, I just stay away from conflict. I don't like conflict at all. And maybe the cultural inputs of your family dynamics, the school, the church you were raised in framed the story of life to be like this. You give, you give, you give, you give until there's nothing left of you. That's the goal. But that is actually not what embracing the way of the cross means. It doesn't mean that you never say no. It doesn't mean that you just let people walk all over you. You know, Jesus doesn't go to the cross merely to signal to others, look how much I'm sacrificing for you. Did you know that throughout Jesus' ministry, there were several other attempts by people to kill Jesus? So there's one example of this. You might not even be aware of this. In Luke 4, Jesus comes out of the synagogue, and the crowd is so upset with him, they actually try to throw him off of a cliff. Now, Jesus doesn't just let them do that and say, hey, I'm going to let you do this, walk all over me, and I'm just going to do it to show you how much I love you. That wasn't the point. The cross was not about just simply, let me show you how much I love you. Let's get back to the very first Bible verse most of you memorized in Sunday school. For God so loved the world that he gave. It's the cross is the way the world gets set right. This was the way that good came to the world. So for some of us, we need to be set free from thinking that the ultimate good of our life is to signal to each other how much we've sacrificed. And I want to give you some real practical examples of how this actually can distort what the way of the cross is. You see this oftentimes in church contexts, and some of these situations are really, really hard. I think about women, and I've heard stories throughout my life of women who have internalized the message as, the message of Jesus is, I just have to keep sacrificing. I have to keep sacrificing. I have to keep sacrificing. And so they'll stay in physically abusive marriages where they've never said no. And they think that that's actually what God is asking them to do, to allow themselves or their children to be abused. That's not the way of the cross. The way of the cross is what is leading to the ultimate good. And sometimes the thing I need to be most thinking about is what is the ultimate good for that abusive husband? His repentance, the cessation of that behavior, the liberation of those women and children. That is the good. And so maybe for that person, the hard thing, the carrying of the cross, might be going up against some kind of maybe inherited instincts to just kind of be like, yeah, I sometimes just let people walk all over me to say, I'm going to do the hard thing, which is for the good of others. So when we are tempted to make this all about how much can I give up, that's not the goal. The goal is, what is the good for not only myself, but for others around me? We love all of the ways that you, each of you, serve in our church community. But I want to tell you that if you log so many hours here in serving our church community that you go home and you're miserable, you know, and you just kind of like, you just spill out all this toxic energy on your family and you go to work, I would invite you to say, please do less things at church, right? God is not calling you to perpetually sacrifice yourself. God is calling us towards the healing of the world. Does that make sense? And so there's a difference between framing this as, what else do I need to do to show people that I'm sacrificing, as what does it cost for the good of the world, for the healing of the world to happen? I want to invite now those who are serving communion to come up to the front, and we're going to prepare for that time. I'm going to invite the band to come forward. And I want to invite us, as we come to the Lord's table, to think about how this table is the very symbol of how all of reality is supposed to work. We aren't just doing a ceremony once a month around here that is like, oh, this is good tradition. What we're saying at this table is that when Christ offered himself, offered his body and blood. He did that. Why? Because he so loved the world. It is through Christ's cross that the world gets set right. So when we come to the table and we think about the way of the cross, some of us who might be tempted towards that domination side, right? I think sometimes, here's a great picture that might help you. You know, maybe you see it like the kind of pre-shows for boxing matches and UFC fights where the two fighters, don't mind me, Jake, they get face-to-face like this, right? And it's kind of like a game of chicken as to who doesn't blink first, right? If you're the kind of person that's like, oh, I have no problem getting nose-to-nose with someone, you know, your temptation might be more towards that, I'm going to dominate. But some of you, if you go, even watching that makes me scared, getting face-to-face, I would be the one to look away quickly. Your temptation might be, I think the whole point of this might be to sacrifice. It isn't. It is at the table that we realize Christ came so that we would not have to go to the cross. We carry our cross, but it is through his cross that the world is set right. So I want to invite you now, before we come to the table here, to take a moment to bow our heads and to invite Jesus to show us, Jesus, what does this way of the cross look like? And at this time, I will invite the servers to come and we'll begin to pass out as we take a moment of reflection.